Just give me a notice after 20 minutes if I talk too much. I don't want to. You've already heard me today. I think I want to.
It's very important.
Give enough space to.
Don't worry.
To someone else. In any case, I think a good way of getting into the subject of what I call the Zionist mindset is to read the diaries of the Zionist early settlers. There were two groups of early settlers of Zionism. The first, who came in the late 19th century, were more classical colonialist type of settlers. Like colonialists elsewhere in the world, they came to exploit the resources of the land, including the human resources of the land, in order to make better life for them compared to the countries of origin. And colonialists, white settlers, all over the world, the same period, and definitely before that period, were building similar models for exploitation and oppression of the local indigenous people for their own sake. However, they were not the people that created the Zionist movement in Palestine. The people who really molded, really formulated Zionism the way we know it, came in what historians like to call the second wave of Zionist settlement. Or in Hebrew they call it Aliyah Shniya, the second ascendance. They came after 1905, after the failure of the first attempt of the Bolshevik movement to topple the Tsarist regime in Russia. And many of them were revolutionaries at heart, who believed up to 1905 that the international revolution would provide a solution to what they called the Jewish problem in Eastern Europe. But the failure of that revolution, or that coup, has moved them into the direction of nationalism. And they were very poor compared to the early settlers, the second wave, very poor, and had very little money on them when they arrived in the port of Jaffa. They knew nothing about how farming and agriculture, because as you know, Jews in Russia and Eastern Europe were not allowed to work on cultivation of land, and had nowhere to stay, and didn't know how to make a living for themselves in the new country called Palestine. So they were very lucky that the local Palestinians hosted them, offered them a place to sleep, a little bit of food, and when they stayed long enough, also taught them how to cultivate the land and how to shepherd the herds and how to become sort of children of the new country. But at night, these settlers, under the candlelight, wrote diaries. They were obsessive diarists. They wrote a lot of, every day they wrote in a diary, which is good for the historian. They wrote about everything. A mosquito bite, they didn't sleep well, a lot about the women they didn't like, the women didn't like the men didn't like the men. But there is nothing that escaped the diary. And in those diaries, in those entries to the diaries, they write about their greatest disappointment to be in Palestine. The main disappointment was that the place was full of foreigners. Especially those, of course, who hosted them. They were the main foreigners. And they were saying in their diaries, and I'm staying tonight in the house of one of these foreigners. And you have to understand this mindset. The mindset is, and hasn't changed, It hasn't changed. There were two disappointments here, to a certain extent. One was that most of them believed the propaganda that Palestine was an empty space, that it was a land without people, waiting for people without land. They really believed it. If you read the propaganda of the Zionist movement after Herzl founded it properly in 1897, Palestine appears as a totally empty land. It's amazing. So they were really, really surprised to see someone else there. Secondly, they had to square this new effect with their idea of creating a new homeland. So they decided if someone was there and was not supposed to be there, they were aliens, hostile aliens, in fact, who usurped, took over something which did not belong to them. Now, if you think that this is simplistic, if you think that this is outdated, think twice. The most important tool for studying the Arab-Israeli conflict in the United States of America today, whether it is in high school or colleges or in the universities, is an atlas called the Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, which was written by one of Britain's leading professors called Martin Gilbert. I think it's already in its 12th edition. Right. And this is the main tool by which students in America, and until recently in England, more or less until I came over, but not because of me, or maybe because of me, I don't know, until recently also in England, was the main cartographic way of looking, or geographical way of looking at the conflict. And I think it tells you a lot of the Zionist propaganda today compared to the Zionist propaganda in the early days. Martin Gilbert's Atlas has, as I say, is a professional tool that most academics in America use in order to understand the history of Palestine. Okay? The first map is Palestine during the biblical times, days of the Bible. The second map is Palestine during the Roman time, at the time that the Jews allegedly were expelled by the Romans. The third map is the Crusader. The fourth map is the first Zionist settlement in 1882, which means that between 70 AD, or between the time of Christ, till the late 19th century, nothing happened in Palestine because it was empty, because there were no people there. And this mindset is still there in Israel. This is Zionism for me. This is really Zionism for me, because Zionism is not saying there are no Arabs around. Of course the people know that there are Palestinians around. They are now, as Ali said today, they are half of the population of Manda, what used to be historical Palestine, today are Palestinians. So you don't deal with a Jewish community that doesn't know that Palestinians exist. But the whole effort is on two levels. One is to make the Palestinians evaporate, disappear, so that we can go back to the land without people. Or, you cannot do this, if you cannot do this, imagine that they are not there. Now, how can you imagine that they are not there? You can build a wall. Many people think wrongly that the wall is meant mainly to enclave the Palestinians. But this is the wall that you are familiar with, the apartheid wall, inside the West Bank and between the West Bank, is not the only wall in Israel. Most of the Jewish well-off communities in Israel that are near Palestinian villages have high walls, higher than the segregation wall. If you have a high wall, you are in a land without people, for the people without land. And this is the two ways that Zionism is operating. Now, what wrongly is called in Germany the Zionist left, or the peace camp in Israel, are the people who live in these gated communities. And they are really minimalist. They are minimalists. They want only a small part of Palestine, it's true, provided it's purely Jewish. This is Meretz. This is the Peace Now movement in Israel. This is probably the worst kind of Zionist manifestation of goodwill that we have. This is the idea, and I know these are my friends. I came from this milieu, so I know exactly what I'm talking about. This is the kind of people who are very nice, and they are really nice. You know them. You adore them in Germany. You give A, B, C, D, E, F, H, Yehoshua, and Amos Oz. You give them prizes, although they're horrible writers, but that's another issue. But you give them prizes like as if they have written the Bible, the Quran, and the New Testament together, and all these human creations are nothing compared to their amazing stories. They're just watching the Goethe Prize, I think, that or the other ones that you are bestowing on these mediocre writers is one of the most embarrassing human ceremonies to watch. But nothing bad. That's a German problem, and that's your idea of culture after the Second World War. Sorry?
German loves prices.
Yeah, they love prices. So you have to deal with what is German culture today. It's another victim of, I think, the Holocaust and the Nazi era, but I won't go into it without being too offensive about it. Now, this is very important to understand, because humanly speaking, this minimalist Zionist approach was within the Zionist movement from the very early period. Just give us a little piece of Palestine. And it sounded so convincing. We are willing, in 1936, this peace movement within Zionism said, you know, one third of Palestine, that's all we want. But of course, with no Arabs in it. And this didn't seem racist to anyone. It seemed like, these are amazing people. Look, all they want is one third. And then, and this is the inner logic of peace Zionists, or what I call Diet Zionists. This is like Diet Coke. It's Zionism without the cocaine. The logic is, when I offered the Palestinian in the 30s 70% and they said no, of course it doesn't stand to reason that I would offer them again only 70%. They have to learn a lesson, because they're Arabs and a bit like children. So we have to be a bit didactic with them. Since they did not accept the 70%, we're now offering them 60%. But the Palestinian movement being an anti-colonialist movement, which is something difficult for Europeans to grasp, because there are many Muslims among the Palestinians. And the Muslim anti-colonialist movement is not like Che Guevara and the people that people like here as anti-colonialists. They don't have these cigars and barrettes, and they shave, or if they don't shave, they have proper beards. So they don't fit well into this anti-colonialist image. You can't sort of put them on big posters, right? Imagine Yasser Arafat on a t-shirt like Che Guevara. It doesn't work. So people forget that actually they are an anti-colonialist movement. They are not different from any other movement that the left has cherished in many ways. And therefore, when this movement says rightly, 40% of our homeland is something a proper anti-colonialist movement cannot accept. Under any conditions, it cannot accept that 60% of its homeland would be in the hand of a colonialist movement. Then comes the third wave, and you're offered 40%, and I don't have to tell you know the story. This, I think we have to focus on that mechanism, because as I said this morning, the sort of mainstream Zionist approach, and definitely the right-wing Zionist approach, is very transparent. And it's a waste of time in this milieu, where we're sitting here together as friends, to say to you why the present Israeli government represents a kind of Zionism that we should not accept and detest and abhor. That's an easy one. Even the Kadima Likud government, or the Kadima Labor government that did the 2006 second assault on Lebanon, or the Gaza massacre, it's not something we should waste time on explaining why this is a bunch of criminals and so on, and we should oppose them and so on. I think our real problem are not these people. Because these people would do the job for us at a very heavy price, I know. A very heavy price. But they would do the job for us, I mean, by the fact that they are not sophisticated, it's not complicated to explain why they are criminals and why their policies are war crimes or crimes against humanity. Our problem comes, and this is the Obama, with this I would end, this is the Obama administration. This is the right, the left wing in Germany. This is the good people on the left in the United Kingdom. And even in Scandinavia. Our problem would be that people would say we want to replace the present horrible Israeli government with an Israeli peace government on the left, on the Zionist left. And the Zionist left would come to the podium and say, yes, forget about the bad days of the Likud, of the right wing. We are not like them. We want a smaller Jewish state without Arabs, not a big Jewish state without Arabs. And they will get the Nobel Peace Prize. The first thing that they will get will be the Nobel Peace Prize. And the second thing that they will get the immunity, because exactly, unlike the people on the left and the center and the right in Israel, they don't talk much. They do. They do. They don't talk much. They will do exactly what this government is doing in Eastern Jerusalem. They will do exactly what this government is doing in the Nakab and in the Galilee. And they would continue the same policies about the right of return and about reconciliation. They'll do the same, but they will talk, as you know, they will talk in a different language. They will talk the discourse of peace. They have no problem in doing it. They are so good at it. They have been doing it for 60 years. They kicked out people and said that the others, there's no one there on the other side to talk to. And when there was someone to talk to, they killed them, and then they said there's no one to talk to. These are the kind of people that we have to focus, and with this I would end, for only one good reason. Because if you accept my analysis, that the Israeli rainbow of idea is like a Scottish pyjama. You know what a Scottish pyjama is? With one stripe. They're very economical, the Scots, so they have only one stripe. This is the Israeli rainbow of ideas within the Zionist frame of mind. And this is not easy to accept, I know, because there is a show of pluralism. There is a charade of a serious debate. The Israelis really perfected this charade of the debate when it came to Gaza. The painful Israeli inner debate about taking out the settlements into new kind of settlements near the Gaza Strip, where they talked about when a settler said that she was put in a 5-star hotel in Ashkelon and it was near the railway station, so it reminded her of Auschwitz. This is the kind of thing that would be most difficult to fight in the social democratic milieu of Germany and of Europe. And in order to fight it properly, we have to go back to the basics. And to come back to what I said this morning, and with this I would end. I really think that you don't have to feel at all timid or frightened by making a very basic human distinction between political organizations and human beings. I'm sure in any other case in the world you do very easily this distinction. You don't feel that you have violated any terrible taboo by saying that the political organization does not represent people. When you talk about Myanmar and you talk about the Burmese people, you don't think that you are talking about the same thing. When you talk about all kinds of other regimes that you don't like, you know that you are not talking generally about the people who live there. Israel is not different. Israel is not different. And it's okay. You know, I was asked I was told that Jeff Alper was saying that there were some good Zionists and bad Zionists and so on. There are no good Zionists. That's an oxymoron. There can be good Zionists. There can be well-meaning Zionists. I accept. There can be well-meaning Zionists, but it's like well-meaning racists. There are like apartheid people with good intentions. Some things, language, as I think Ali said to us, that language tolerates everything. But that doesn't mean that everything that the language tolerates makes sense. So, yes, there are people living in Israel who are nice, generous, peace-loving, a Jewish, progressive, whatever you want. But as long as they are loyal to this ideology, the way they explain to you their ideology, of course, there isn't an objective definition, but the way they understand it, which is the way that they educate their children, this is the way in which they understand the role of the army and the military in their society. And this is the way as they accept for granted and without any question the basic decisions of their political and military elites. When you take this into account, there is nothing positive about it. And you should negate it and not accept it in its totality. Not play with it. And you are doing a very important, or you are carrying out a very important mission for the people themselves. And I tell Israelis whenever they want to hear me that they don't know what they are missing. I know. I said, you don't know what you're missing when you be deprogrammed. I told them how long, and this is my book, Out of the Frame. I told them how long it took me to be deprogrammed. And I said, you don't understand the sensation. If you think you need LSD, or you need to drink a lot, or to hear the rabbis, or whatever makes you kick in Israel, you don't know what you're missing. You can do the trip that I did, and you will feel so good with yourself, like very, very few people around the world. I'm serious about it, because once you liberate yourself from an ideology that was sacred in your eyes, and made you do things that you regret, once you are on the other side of the mirror, you feel something that you almost feel fortunate to be able to experience such a journey. I think very religious people maybe sometimes experience it when they have an epiphany or revelation. I'm not very religious, so I don't know what it means. But I know what it means in my case. If you have any problems with telling Israelis that they should stop being Zionists, including those you like in the Zionist left camp, tell them to walk the extra mile, whether they are rabbis for peace, or DJs for peace, or transvestites for peace, or I don't know what, milkmen for peace. Israelis have all these they like to fragment the peace movement. They like to fragment the peace movement, makes it easier for them. Instead of saying, we are anti-Zionists for peace, for instance. That would be the real, genuine Israeli movement for peace. If you tell them, believe me, you are sending them on the best journey in their life. Thank you. Thank you.